Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should. Here's your host, Mark Davin.
All right, people, we have with us somebody that I've been wanting to talk to for a long time. I've been into him since his first record, and he's got a new record. It's called Strange Days. And I've been really immersing myself in this record. And as I listened to it, I thought to myself, wow, this is such a soulful record from a guitarist. He's a singer. He's a songwriter who's based on his body of work. I'm not sure if he's on loan from the gods or not. You know, the gods of tone, at least. And I fear that someday they might want to take him back. Hopefully that day won't come. We have with us Mr. Ian Moore. How are you, Ian?
Well, that was a great intro. You want to travel with me and do that every night? Or maybe just tell my wife every day who she's speaking to so she could refer to me appropriately.
You know? No, it's interesting, man. You know, it's so interesting to follow your career. You know, your first two records are really guitar-centric records. And then suddenly this thing happened with you. You were like, okay, it's more about songs. At least that's my impression. That I was like, it's more about songs. And you still tear it up every once in a while. You tease us, you know. Like for example, on the track Hercules on the new record, you know, there's these two lead breaks in there that are just like make the guitar player go, hold on, everybody, shut up, listen.
Yeah, I think Hercules is, like, as far as like that type of playing, is the best playing I've ever had on tape for me, for what I think it is. If you're like a geek, if you're really into, you know, taking the journey, which is like this, that anybody that plays the guitar can relate to. I think one of the things that has happened with me is I'm always taking a journey, and whether it's into songs and the construction of songs, or even like into, you know, studio and recording. You know, it's the same vibe as playing the guitar and getting into microphones, mm-hmm. and recording techniques, and it's all the same to me. And even like, I'd say on To Be Loved and El Sonido, which are the two records prior to this one. Mm-hmm. You know, those are they're guitar records, but they're a little different. Like, it's, you know, there's different types of guitar players. Like, you know, you got your Mike Campbells.
Yeah.
And then you got your, like, you know, Jimi Hendrix. Well, Jimi Hendrix does everything, so he's not fair. You can't remember. But, you know, so, like, I think of, like, those two records of mine, they're super guitar records. Matter of fact, they're some of the coolest guitar things that I ever did. Mm-hmm. There's just not a ton of, like, crazy solos on them. But as far as, like, really cool, like on To Be Loved, there's this killer riff on Innocent Maneuvers, which is this doubled, you know, junior into a Tweed Deluxe. Mm-hmm. It's just epic. I mean, it's like, as far, you know, like a Brian May guitar player necessarily, but like that's definitely my kind of like stepping into that realm for a second, you know, like put my toe in it. So, you know, it's the beauty of having a career to me is the freedom of playing in this big playground, and you're the one that gets to define how big it is.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I it's interesting. Is it safe to say you're a tone junkie?
Well, no, if I'm a tone junkie, I love, of course, I have a lot of work to do. I feel like, as a matter of fact, just before we got on this phone call, the guys at Guitar Sanctuary are rebuilding my pedal boards. First time ever somebody externally has built my pedal board. And I was just talking to Clint, and we're working on this kind of V-switching system that's going to integrate, you know, the thing with the, you know, analog loops and the MIDI thing, because I'm using some of this Strymon stuff. And I'm really working on it right now. I just go in different phases, man. I mean, again, there are so many different tones. Like, so, for instance, I was really into building amps. I still am, but I had a bit more time a few years ago. And I was building all these EL84 amps because I just love the sound of those amps. Mm-hmm. You know, like the Vox AC30, AC15 area, they don't do everything that I need them to do. When you hit them with a big fuzz, they kind of go, leave me alone, you're being so mean, you know, like, yeah. they just don't. But agility for clean, or what you call clean in parentheses, because there's not clean, it's this unbelievably three-dimensional, chewy, clean tone. Whereas a fender can be kind of a little bit kind of, I mean, that's a beautiful sound too, but they're a bit different. So, like, I got super into that for a while. And, you know, I mean, that journey alone, just in the, I mean, look, we could be talking in this four different dimensions, but just in the type of power tubes you use in your amps, that's a huge definition of the sound that you're going to be doing and what you're getting and how you play and, you know.
Oh, absolutely. It's so funny. I just had Eric Tesmer on the show, and you came up in conversation.
No way.
Yeah, about a guy who, you know, basically can, you're one of those guys who can sit there and like Eric Johnson too, can sit there and go, that, you know, you can almost bias the amp by ear.
Well, I'm not in the league of Eric, but yeah, I mean, I had it was a real nice thing for me when I started building amps, because I had gotten so frustrated with, you know, people basically just telling me who to be and what to be and who I was. And I was just trying to find some freedom. So I basically put the electric guitar down and said, okay, fine. All right. Let's see who I am without all this stuff that you guys say is who I am. And so I did, and I loved that. And that, I mean, that alone, even from a guitar player standpoint, even though that wasn't my intention, that was a whole nother revolution, because then all of a sudden you're dealing with acoustic guitars, and it's like, whoa, I just stepped in this gigantic room that I thought acoustic guitars were just like the other guitar you picked up when you weren't playing electric. And you realize, oh shit, this is this whole other, you know, like, yeah. People that know acoustic guitars treat them like, they're like camera lenses. Like, they're so unique. Like, Daniel Lenoir, when I was recording with him, he had a room full of pre-war Martins that were all tuned to different tunings according to the temperament of the wood. You know, so when I went through that phase and really, really dug it and really got into finger picking and kind of just working on some, I guess, different ways of looking at the guitar. And then the way I got back at the electric guitar was by building amps. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of a revolution for me, because I didn't think about it like, oh, I'm going to be playing electric guitar. It was more like, wow, this is really cool. And I was into it from a technical standpoint. Well, then when you build the amp, you have to check it out and see how it works. Mm-hmm. Does it sound right? Is it bias right? And then you start to get in there. And what I found myself doing is I would be in my studio, and then 3 hours went by, and I was like, oh my God, this is like what it felt like when I was 15 years old and I just picked up a guitar, and I'm like, holy, this is the coolest thing in the world. And and that's kind of how I kind of got back into really, really playing the electric guitar and feeling like, you know, that same feeling, like it adds all these dimensions. You can make all these different sounds. It can be gentle. It can be powerful. It can be, you know, anything, like trippy and weird or searing. And because in the acoustic guitar, for me, I mean, obviously with a brilliant acoustic guitar player like a John Fay, Bert Jansch, any of those kind of guys, you know, they can probably do all that stuff. I couldn't. I felt always a little limited. I would try to use pedals and stuff like that. But, you know, so it really brought me back into the full, I'm a guitar player again, and that kind of, you know, that fun celebration of what it is to unleash this, all that wattage and the power, you know, and it's pretty fucking awesome.
Try and explain to us when the first time that you picked it up again and you plugged in, what was that like? Was it like brand new again to you?
Yeah, because it's that thing of like, one of my strongest memories when I was young and starting out was, I had my Super Reverb, which is the amp I started playing. It was a CVS era, but it had all the, you know, it was that transition model. And I had an Echoplex that I bought really early on because, you know, of course, huge Hendrix fan growing up in Austin. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody had Echoplexes and all that stuff. And I remember sitting on my guitar amp and having the Echoplex set, and it just felt like this magical feeling. And it's funny, I actually was on the phone one time with Strymon, and I did feel like Eric Johnson, because I was telling them that their Echoplex modeling wasn't right, and then I was trying to explain it. And I actually had sat there before I called him because I didn't want to sound like an asshole, and really tried to find a way to quantify what was different about it.
Right.
And there was something. So there was this really magical feeling that I felt when I was playing that, and I've always remembered it as one of my favorite feelings, actually, in my whole life. This really, it makes me think of like morning dew. In the countryside, it has a very, very distinctive sound and feel to me. And when I started playing the guitar again, you know, building an amp, I think it was probably an EL84 amp because I was super into them. Similar thing, just kind of there's a timbre to those amps. You know, when you really turn them up, mm-hmm. no pedals, straight in, P90s or like Power Strat, and they just have this kind of beautiful. I mean, the high end's piercing when it's quiet, you know how an AC30 is just like super trebly, but when you turn it up, the treble kind of attenuates a little bit, and it just becomes this beautiful singing sound that's unlike the old 34. And I was just sitting there playing it, and my, you know, just going, oh my God, this is like all these overtones, and it's just beautiful. It's like drinking a really, really nice glass of wine or having a great meal, mm-hmm. and it just kind of pulled me back into mm-hmm. that feeling again that I felt that with the Super and the Echoplex.
And so now, I mean, I want to get to the record in a second, but now you're building amps. You've got a signature line of amps coming out.
Well, the signature line is actually a company called Holy Watt.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I had been playing Jackson Ampworks, which is an amazing company out of Fort Worth, and Brad builds these brilliant amps. I mean, his amps are like engineering feats. And the thing with their company was Brad would, you know, let me try out an amp, and then I would be like, man, I love this, Brad. But there'd always not like a big butt, but just like a little like, hey, what if, you know, did this? And it was kind of like the amp line was already done, and it was kind of like find an amp that works for you and play it. And I always felt like I was like, you know, 88% there. Mm-hmm. And so I ran into this guy, Jim. He's an East Texas guy. He's friends with a bunch of friends of mine in East Texas, Wes and Tyler and a bunch of folks. He's got a couple of people playing them. And we started talking, and he was like, what about if I made you an amp to your specs? And I was like, yes, please. Let's do it. I mean, I've kind of done that before over the years, but it's always been like, you know, back when I was younger, I just didn't know technically what I wanted. And so we were able to really hone in on, you know, the topology of it. And, you know, I knew for me, I wanted to do a L6 amp as opposed to an L34 amp or EL84 or 66. And, you know, general, you know, I wanted a Fender-y amp. I wanted a little bit of a different reverb sound. I wanted a little bit of a different tone stack. And so we started messing with it. And he was so cool and easy to communicate with. And we just went back and forth, you know. And the way I told him, I said, you know, because he would send me something and I played in my studio. And I said, you know, Jim, I need to take it on the road and use it night after night to really give you an honest opinion, because one room just doesn't work it out. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, 6-8 months later, we've put it on. We've got two models. We've got a 30 watt and a 15 watt. And, you know, to me, you know, there's a lot of great amps being made right now, but to me, it's everything that I want in an amp. It's a simple design. It doesn't have a lot of extra bells and whistles. It's not, it is made for a really solid classic sound with a beautiful reverb that sits well, you know, on the level. It's a player's amp. It's not mm-hmm. necessarily meant to be played. You know, I think some boutique amps are meant to be played in a room by themselves.
Yeah.
And this amp is meant to be played on the stage. And actually, there's a couple of things that we did, you know, because when you take stuff on the road and you have esoteric stuff in your design and then it breaks and you're in Wyoming, mm-hmm. you can't do anything.
Yeah.
So we really worked on that, too. I wanted to make sure it was really sturdy. And we're debuting them at the Dallas Guitar Show.
That is so cool. I'm looking forward to that. And yeah. folks are going to be able to go and try them out and all that jazz, right?
Yeah, and I'm going to be there whatever the day of our show is. I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm going to try to come up early and hang out, you know, in the booth for a while. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, obviously, I'm the same as you. I can talk about this kind of stuff for days. You know,
I can dig it.
Yeah.
So I'm always curious to know, and this goes for songwriting and for guitar playing itself. How much of it for you is, how much of it is cerebral? How much of it is it heart?
I would definitely say that I fall more in the heart realm. I mean, I do try to be. I really dig cerebral players because they're different mm-hmm. from me. Mm-hmm. So I always, you know, when I see players where I'm like, wow, that guy's obviously very, very mathematical or very smart. You know, but for me, what I believe in, and maybe that's because I grew up, you know, fundamentally playing a lot of blues when I was young and, you know, really reacting to nuance of these different emotions, you know, the way Otis Rush vibratos as opposed to Albert King or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I practice technique when I can, and I'm definitely aware of things. And when I play, I want to be a big bundle of blood and mm-hmm. emotions, and I just don't want to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's just it's like you're a conduit.
Well, hopefully, I mean, you know, I think. I mean, I think that's the optimal way, and the guitar players and songwriters and humans in general. I mean, I think, you know, what I like in a guitar is what I like in a human. You know, I like things and people that are who they are, mm-hmm. you know, and I like, really like to see the person in mm-hmm. the playing. You know, my favorite players are, you know, I'm a big Richard Thompson fan. I'm a big Mike Campbell fan. I'm a big fan of people where they play and you go, yeah, yeah. You know, mm-hmm. I really like to see the person's soul yeah, come yeah. out of their guitar amplifier.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because when you normally don't get to hear guitar players that you like. You don't normally get to speak with them, talk with them, and hear their vocabulary. So more often, their playing is their vocabulary for the listener.
Yeah. And it's so cool to hear, you know. I mean, you know, I've been doing this long enough where I've been able to travel around the world. And I mean, you know, I remember this one. We were 2 years ago in Azerbaijan. And there was this kid. He was like 11. And they just trotted him out. And he was this, you know, he played the guitar. I mean, not like any guitar player I've ever seen, but it was a guitar and he was playing it. But, you know, he was playing it, you know, in the style that he grew up with, which I don't even remember the name of the native instrument. Azerbaijan is a Middle East territory that's occupied by Russia. And, you know, it was these very fast pull-offs, very Arabic sounding. And, you know, it's just so amazing to see, you know, the way the instrument, that's what's so cool about the guitar. And I always explain it sometimes defensively to people that are like, oh yeah, electric guitar, wow, everyone plays one. It's like, well, yes, it's a ubiquitous instrument in Western culture, but you know what's cool about it? It's not defined. Mm-hmm. And what the way Eddie Van Halen plays it is different from the way Billy Gibbons plays it, which is mm-hmm. different from the way, you know, the next person plays it. You know, everybody takes the same plank of wood and strings and pickups and turns it into completely a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's pretty open-ended.
Yeah, and then there's the actual DNA component that goes along with that. You know, the actual, you know, your flesh on those strings and on that wood is going to be completely different than Billy's or Eddie's or...
Oh, I know.
Or, you know, you know, so...
You know, you are who you are. And I mean, look, I used to get, obviously, you know, if you know anything about my career, it was really frustrating when I was young, constantly being compared to Steve Ray Vaughan.
Yes.
I mean, and no disrespect to him at all. I mean, he was one of the best guitar players, and I was lucky to grow up seeing him and knowing him. But when I was young, it was frustrating because, you know, obviously I was trying to find my own voice.
Mm-hmm.
I now laugh about it because literally, I'm not kidding, I will do a show where I don't even play a solo. I don't play anything bluesy. I'm like using like an echo set on Eternity and Chorus, trying to sound like somebody from The Cure, or just, you know, just for fun, like playing with a friend's band or whatever.
Right.
And I swear to God, somebody would come up to me and be like, dude, you sound just like Stevie Ray Vaughan.
No.
I'm like,
really?
What I think it is I think it's almost like this, it's an energetic thing or something. Like,
yeah.
there's just a point in, you know, the way you express yourself that is a tribal iconographic thing. And what, you know, it used to really get under my skin and be like, you know, now I look at it as like, you know, yeah, that's kind of where I'm from. I mean, those are my people. You know, I grew up with Denny and Stevie and Jimmy Vaughan and Doug Somm and all those are my people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, just like you should echo your father's energy but be your own man, mm-hmm. I am of that tribe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess you are. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. I think there's a lot of players in Austin that feel that way. You know,
sure.
You know, I mean, Doyle Bramall. Probably, you know, I think, you know, I remember when Archangels hit, it was like, everyone was like, oh, this is the guy who's going to, he's the heir apparent, you know, and he was like, no, thanks, I'm going this way, and he did.
Well, and the beauty, I mean, Doyle is one of my favorite guitar players, and I'm a huge fan. I think, as a matter of fact, you know, I wouldn't put him in the idiom. I don't really use genres in general, but just if you were to say kind of the dudes that kind of play the funky bluesy shit, I mean, he is tops for me. And he completely has his own voice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if anything, he kind of like just phrasing wise echoes Jimmy Vaughan because he plays in these little like, boom, blah, blah, blah,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
And that is a Jimmy Vaughan thing for sure. And he grew up with Jimmy. But, mm-hmm. you know, man, Doyle's got totally his own sound.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that's the point. It's like, you know, guitar is, it's, you know, you can do whatever you do. People hear it how they do. Some people are very discerning and really hear nuance. And other people, you know, they just want to relive some guitar player they liked before. And if you sound like that guy, they're psyched that you did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So let's talk about this record, because I took notes on this record big time. And
right on.
There are certain tracks on here that just are such amazing standouts for me. And... well, first, let's talk about the title track. What made you decide that this was going to be the title track?
Well, that song in particular was a really heavy tune to me, and it's funny that it came out now. I was doing an interview earlier today for one of the stops on our tour, and you know, I wrote that song like 2 years ago. I'd seen a documentary called The Act of Killing. It's about the Indonesian death squads.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of wrote about it because it really blew my mind. Like, I was thinking about, you know, okay, when we think of evil, when we think of like, man, that motherfucker, that dude is really evil. At least in my mind, it's always someplace distant. It's another place. Like, we think of Hitler, or we think mm-hmm. of Mussolini, or we think of this guy. But when you watch this documentary, it makes you realize that we're all capable of being that dude. We're all capable of being this. And so, in other words, there's gradients of losing ourselves along the way, when you reflect on your life and you, if you're honest with yourself, you go, man, I was a real asshole for that whatever time period, mm-hmm. hopefully a quantifiable time period. And then you go, you know, I really need to, you know, I need to be nicer to my friends, or I need to tell, you know, my wife I love her more often, or my children, or, you know, my mom or dad. And those are the same things. And really, it's a series of gradients when all of a sudden, you know, it's this definitive space. And so that's the gist of that song. Mm-hmm. And I wrote it, and when I started writing it, I originally wrote it over this very meditative Black Uhuru kind of vibe, which is they're this reggae group that I used to see as a kid, and it had this real ominous thing, and the song evolved quite a bit over the recording process, which is so fun because, you know, normally when I record a song, I have an idea of what it's going to sound like top to bottom mm-hmm. already, mm-hmm. and so to just let go of that and kind of let it metamorphosized was really liberating for me.
That's interesting. So, I mean, because to me, I don't like to label things because then people get a preconceived notion. You know, it's sort of like Pat Metheny said to me once that he doesn't like to title his songs. He would rather not title them because he doesn't want to put a visual imprint in the listener's mind.
Well, that makes sense, especially with his music, because he really seems to thrive in kind of the ethereal space,
yeah, absolutely.
Where there's a lot left to in the unknown.
Yeah, you know? But this record, to me, in many respects, with the exception of "Merry Go Round," which I want to talk about, this record is very R&B.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and yeah, well, really refreshing, like bordering on neo soul, which I hate that term, but. But does that make sense?
Well, yeah. I mean, those are musics that are so deep inside of me and things that I just love. And, you know, at this point, my brain and soul, they're like prisms. I mean, I have so many different – I have another record that I did that isn't out that's like a power – guitar record, like intense. I don't know how to explain it, but you know, and this record, it was really fun for me because I was able to kind of go to kind of pull it into a space and set some parameters and create this really soulful, you know, I was digging into, like, for sure, like bedroom soul,
yes,
you know, some kind of Sly Stone funkadelic kind of,
yes,
bit of funk on the edges, and then,
yes,
and enough, you know, enough rock that it's not. You know, I didn't want to be the dude, and you know, no disrespect at all to Leon Bridges, because that dude's awesome and amazing, and I'm so psyched there's a young kid that's going out there trying to do that thing. But I just, you know, I don't want to put on a different outfit. They're all me.
Right.
And I'm just going to get out there, and, you know, this record's a little bit more soul-oriented and funk-oriented and mm-hmm. psychedelic, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's where it's at.
Yeah, it's so cool. And so, like for example, for like Hercules, which is, you know, I vacillate. Right now, that's like my favorite tune.
Right on.
But when I heard it, the very first time I heard it, I wrote these notes. I wrote, tapping into his inner Curtis Mayfield with brutal lead breaks that are absolute blissful guitar pornography.
Well, it was really fun for me. I loved revisiting, you know, that was a tone that, you know, that I really felt, you know, was kind of a imprint tone. Not that I'm the first person to do it, but, you know, like I took the Octavia sound that Hendrix used a lot, put a fuzz after it in the mid-90s. That was a really, really big part of my sound.
Yeah.
And it was really fun to kind of revisit that, and I love the phrasing on that solo.
It's
kind of
so
like
good.
Because it's definitely got that Hendrix vibe, but it's really phrasing wise, almost like almost Billy Gibbons, like early Gibbons stuff. Like there's some real, you know, like, you know how he's always super. He's just so. He's so so melodic,
yeah,
you know, and really, really aware. Such a cool, yeah, laid back thing,
yes, yes,
which was cool to do with that big octave uh-huh, vibe, because you don't normally hear that.
Yeah, I say, you know, when I hear Billy play, I say it's like he's soulful in the box.
Yeah, but yeah, exactly. Like in a very, it's almost like a, yeah, it's, it, but you know, when you're, it's interesting because when you're young, you think it's all about just fire. But really what you start to realize is a really, really great players, you know, I mean, of course, you know, these, it sounds silly to even say it, but it really is restraint. Restraint makes chaos have form.
Mm-hmm. That's a great quote. That's great. Yeah, absolutely. Wow. Absolutely. So I just love how simple the groove, how a simple groove can take you all around the world.
Yeah. You know? Those are, you know, just to be fair to the players and everybody on this record, these are amazing, amazing. I mean, in my opinion, some of the best players alive. But I mean, that's JJ and George, you know, that's JJ Johnson and George Reef. And, you know, I mixed that song. That's the first time I've ever actually mixed a tune on a record. And I really worked on it because I don't have a lot of experience as a mixer, so I really wanted to have I wanted to get the kick drum and the bass just perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat there for hours and hours and hours with the drums and bass, and I really listened to them, and I had this kind of epiphany after about 3 hours, which was that George and JJ belong in the conversation with the great rhythm sections of all time. And, you know, whether anyone ever says that other than me, you know, I don't know, but they do. And they're every bit as good as anyone else that came before them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, if you wanted to dissect it, if anybody wanted to ever argue with me, which I would suggest not to do in this particular circumstance, I could really put it down to why it's so great.
Yeah.
Because there's so much subtlety, there's so much ferocity in their playing, but like, you know, you listen to the drums, so just tune out the guitar for a moment, and JJ's playing is just like, it's like, I mean, just laying it down.
Yeah.
And then George does this thing that when you understand, you know, blues, rock, guitar, and psychedelic rock and all that, there's so many little subtle things that the great bass players did that, you know, like Tommy Shannon would do, any of the players that played with, like, Johnny Winter, Stevie Hendrix, any of that type of stuff, like little walking lines,
yeah,
are just perfect. And they're not too jazzy where it starts to sound, you know, too fusion-y, but they're just taking it out enough where you know you're on a psychedelic journey for a minute. And that is, to me, high art. And so George and JJ, what they contributed to that track,
yeah,
cannot be understated, because my playing is elevated and juxtaposed by what they're doing underneath. Mm-hmm.
That totally makes sense. Absolutely. And the snare drum on there is killer.
Oh God, I know. And just, I mean, for me, that's what was so fun about this record is, you know, it's like when it wasn't JJ, it was Sekiu, who's the guy in Saturday Night. He plays in like 24/7 Spies, and just insane drummer, you know. And when it wasn't him, it was John Spies, who's the guy that plays with Grupo Fantasma and Brownout. So just, you know, real second line, and it was just so fun. You know, it made me so grateful that I kind of did a record of like really funky grooves, so I could hear killer drummers just laying it out.
Yeah, totally. It's a sonic meal. Absolutely. So yeah, so like Saturday Night, like you just mentioned, my notes are, it's such a mature tune.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's but with another, a really infectious R&B groove.
Yeah, man, it's you know, it's, I mean, I describe that tune, I say it sounds like, not that I can sing like CeeLo, but it sounds like CeeLo fronting ZZ Top to me.
Yeah, that's okay, what it sounds, cool, yeah.
'Cause it's like the guitar is like,
yeah,
and it's super funky, but then you're such a beautiful child, and then we got that whole crazy Temptations, woo-hoo!
Yeah, yeah,
going in the
totally.
I can't wait to play that song live.
Because yeah,
because when we play it, you can play it kind of more. It's right on the line where it reminds me of like Hendrix playing like Sergeant Pepper's. Like, have you ever heard that live version of him doing the Beatles tune?
Yes.
It's got that kind of lopey thing where you can totally go to that kind of the way Hendrix would kind of. So much of his style rhythmically is from playing, you know, behind Little Richard and all those guys. Mm-hmm. He has all those killer double stop things.
Yeah.
So we can do that, but at the same time, kind of what I feel like is the real hat trick, you know, with this particular band that we're touring with is that we do that, and then I've got four dudes that can sing harmony like they're in Jellyfish. Wow. You know, so.
Wow.
So, pretty epic.
So now, when you are doing these live, are they coming across a little grittier, maybe a little like sleazier?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we just let them open up. You know, I mean, really, you know, when we do the tunes, you know, there's a couple of tunes like we're still working on My Girl. Like we can kill it on acoustic. Like we do that as like a radio song. Like we pile onto a radio station, and then it blows people away because of all the harmonies and stuff. And like I Will Carry On, it's such an emotional tune. It never changes chords in the whole song.
Yeah, so
there's not like for that. I'm really trying to get to the essence of the emotion of it. But the rest of the tunes on the record, we're just jamming. We just jam. We just try to. We learn them, and then we try to jam them, and we try to not think about it a lot, and just let them. You know, like the end of Strange Days, we do this crazy long fade out that reminds me. What's that Crosby, Stills, and Nash song? That she left me with a suitcase stand before my eyes. It's like a mid-70s tune. It's got that Stephen Stills just this crazy kind of like probably Les Paul. It's an amazing boxy tone. So we do this whole kind of little bit of a jazzy fade out on that tune that's totally different than the vibe on the record.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, just because it's the band and we're letting, you know, the band is the band and it becomes its own thing.
Right. Right. Well, yeah. I mean, after a while, yeah, the more that you play these tunes, how long have you been rehearsing them now?
Well, some of the tunes we've been playing for a while on the road, like Strange Days, we've been playing on and off for a few months now. And then a little bit on I Will Carry On, Hercules, same deal.
Yeah.
Just trying to kind of bring them in because, you know, with the thing about tunes like that is that you know, they come alive over time. Mm-hmm. They take on a new life. And if you just start playing them when your record comes out, they're going to be kind of stiff. So I like to kind of we're already running with them and we already have a voice with the songs.
Right. That's what I was getting at. It's like it already becomes like a cement mixer. It's just this thing that's just grinding, you know, because everybody is the on those songs, the telepathy is all happening already. With everybody.
So we're the meaty songs we've been playing for a while. The more kind of poppier songs we really are working on to put, you know, that's more of a, it's just a little bit of a different trip, you know?
Yeah. So it's like, I Will Carry On. It's funny. I wrote it's modern and intellectual R&B. But I wrote that when Butch Walker hears that, he's going to want to kill himself.
I doubt that. Butch is an old friend of mine.
Oh, no kidding.
I know Butch.
I mean, that's something that I think he would yearn to write.
Oh, I don't know. I mean,
he's a great writer.
He's such a good writer. I mean, I would hope so. Maybe I'll have to get it to him. I mean, it's you know, that tune was that's a really interesting song if you want to talk the genesis of songwriting.
Yeah, please.
It was, again, you know, so what, and this is what I tell people, like younger players, like, and it just depends on what you want to do in your life and in your career. But for me, it's the journey. And I'm just like, I just want to do cool shit. I mean, I'm always trying to get better. I'm always working on my voice, on my guitar playing, on my songwriting. But I'm also just trying to kind of do things I haven't done.
Mm-hmm.
And so that song was really interesting in that I wrote it originally. I was actually watching the BET Awards. And I am in love not in love like in lust, but in love with Mary J. Blige. And I always have that. I just something about her. Mm-hmm. Just something about her speaks to me. And so I just wrote this song while watching her. I've never met her. I don't know a lot about her. And it was this crazy, sound like a Teddy Pendergrass song. Real hard soul. And that was the original tune, I Will Carry On. It had a lot of chords in it. It was like this Detroit hard soul. Like you wouldn't even recognize it. Like if we'd recorded it like that, it was like fast and had horns on it and would have been a totally different trip. Anyhow, I tried and tried and tried to figure out how to make that song come alive. And the first minute and a half were just epic. And then it would get to the bridge and it would just kind of just couldn't go anywhere. It was like there was nowhere. It was so intense. And so I'd kind of given up on it. And I was recording with Jim Greer, who's an amazing producer. Just did some stuff with Angela from Fishbone and did Macy Gray stuff. And he's more in the hip-hop realm. And so I went down to Oakland to record with him, and we were going to record My Girl, which is the, you know, just total bedroom soul tune. And I knew how that one was going to go, and I'm like, okay, here's the deal. Let's just try to get My Girl. We know what it's going to be. I can hear it in my head. Let's just make it epic. And he's like, well, let me just mess around with I Will Carry On. He's like, he goes, why don't you go, you know, tomorrow, come in at like 1. Give me a couple hours. And so I come in at 1. And this has never happened to me. I'm not a dude that like walks in and sings over other people's stuff. Like I'm a songwriter. I really like the chordal structures, harmonic arrangement. That's kind of my deal. But he came up with this arrangement, and he's like, what do you think? And he was real timid about it. Like, I hope I didn't offend you by doing this. I'm like, dude, this is the coolest thing. And so I took the song and recorded just without any – there were no vocals. And I took it, and I rewrote all the lyrics. And I went on a hike, and I was sitting up on the Oakland Hills overlooking the San Francisco Bay. And I was thinking about Otis Redding, and I was thinking about my life and just all the, just kind of all the chances, you know, where you feel like you don't, maybe your career's over and you don't have anything going on. And I wrote that song and I came back in and sang it. And it was such a cool moment because I, in my 30 years of recording and touring, I had never one time done that.
That's cool. So what do you think, it was just the right moment in time?
Well, I think it was trusting, you know, somebody and then letting the effort.
Just letting go.
Yeah. And also realizing that, you know, for me, like I said, you know, I'm at this point where people have been telling me I'm wrong and that, you know, what are you doing, this and that. People have been, you know, I'm not saying it's unique to me, but I'm just, this is my experience. They've been criticizing or judging me my whole career and telling me what to do and how to do it. And you know, at a certain point, it was actually all that criticism became a liberation. And it's just like, you know what? I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody's going to tell me what to do. And in coming to that point, you stop fighting and then you stop worrying about it. And then when you stop worrying about it, it doesn't matter. Because really, really, in the great scheme of things, you know, what do I have to lose at this point? Mm-hmm. So for me, it was just really trusting the process, and Jim is killer dude. And I listen to that song, and every time I listen to it, it makes me happy. And if that were the only thing that came out of that recording, that would have been worth it, because, you know, I'm inspired by it. And,
right.
And it's funny because now that tune, of the people that have heard it, maybe because just of the time, and there's just a lot of angst right now in our, you know, in our communities and country, and people react to it. It's a real emotional tune. Yeah. You know?
Well, I mean, the majority of people that pick up an instrument to play, they usually don't pick it up to please others. It's for them. So it makes sense that this was for you before anybody else.
Sure. And well, the ultimate gift to somebody else is something that makes you happy. You know, I think when you're turned on by the thing that you're doing, it's going to be cooler.
I totally agree. Absolutely. So are you going to be playing How Can I live?
We will eventually. eventually. It may take us a little while. The one thing, that's the thing that always is a little tricky when you're getting pretty ambitious, is that, to me, playing that song without the horns is really hard.
Yeah.
I have done it a couple of times, actually. I've tried it. But it's really tricky to pull off. I can barely play it and sing it at the same time. I actually need to, if we're not doing it this tour, my goal is to work it up for the next tour.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm going to need to sit down, and because I'm doing all of this crazy stuff on the guitar while singing a lot of words.
Yeah, and it's a great vocal, too. It seems like a demanding vocal.
It's a pretty demanding vocal. Mm-hmm. You know, but no, I love that tune. And it's, I mean, I'm, you know, that's totally one of my bags. I mean, I grew up listening to that. The super trippy psychedelic funk. I mean, to me, that just says. I mean, the pervading theme that I hear more than anything on this record, and definitely three of the tunes, is P-funk over and over. I hear it in the synthesizer on mm-hmm. Strange Days. Mm-hmm. I hear it for sure in that song. How Can I Do? I mean, it almost sounds like George Clinton could sue me. Hopefully not. it's a really, really pervasive thing. And, you know, it's kind of funny because, you know, there's all this soul stuff's coming back and everybody's real new stuff, but nobody, you know, I mean, nobody digs in the P-funk thing, largely because it's so trippy. It's hard to pull off, you know, mm-hmm. which is why I'm going to have to practice a lot.
Oh, yeah. If you go back and listen to, like, you know, Maggot Brain and stuff like that, it's like, it was psychedelic funk.
Yeah, it's pretty much one of a kind. I mean, you can definitely tell, like, Eddie Hayes and all the Blackburn, all those guys are huge Hendrix fans, but yeah. Even in trying to be like them, they sound completely different.
No, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, the one track that, to me, it's the last track on the record that is like, okay, here I go, I'm going to do a left turn here, is Merry-Go-Round. And it's like, it was such an excellent blend of acoustic and electric guitar. It's a real, like, a sonic tapestry, you know, it's the weaving in of acoustic and electric. It's really eerie. It's even more eerie than, like, that track from Luminaria, What I've Done.
Oh, yeah. This tune, I think just because I'm so used to having to self-describe, so I apologize for sounding like a marketing guy, but it reminds me, it's like Nina Simone with Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys orchestrating
the
song.
Yeah, okay, that's cool.
It was played by Jay Mascis of Dinosaur Jr. You know, it's just a trippy tune, and that's a really good example. So for me, I feel like I'm becoming a pretty good recording engineer, but that one of the things that I love in recording is I love doing shit wrong
mm-hmm.
on purpose because I like the sounds. And so what that does, that particular song, there's some major phase shit going on. And what it does is when you listen to the verses and then goes into the chorus, the phase shifts. And I did that on purpose. The phase, and by phase for people that are not recording, it's not phases and a phaser, but it's actually the phase of the recording. So it goes in and out of phase, and the stereo image shifts around,
mm-hmm.
which to a recording engineer in the traditional sense is a major no-no. That's like super amateur recording. But to me, because it's a very, very you're playing like with your consciousness, kind of. It sounds like a lost person, and when you get to the choruses, it's like you're very angry and focused, and so it comes into kind of a center phase, and then the phase kind of moves to the sides during the verses. You know, maybe no one else notices that, but to me, it has a subtle affect that affects the way you take in the song, and it makes it sound kind of creepier.
It definitely has an eerie vibe to it, without a doubt.
Yeah. Well, I'm a huge fan of Skip Spence. I'm a huge fan of, you know, I love the guy in the studio losing his mind. And though I'm relatively sane, I'm in touch with, you know, that internal madness. I think we all are. And you know, for me, again, part of recording and part of making a record and part of, you know, I love the expanse of it. You know, I don't want to have a record and go, okay, here's my crayon. It's purple. You know, I want to have the whole crayon box for the record. Uh-huh. And, you know, for me, that the putting that song on the end of this record was, because it's a soul tune, barely. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. it's in there, but it's kind of like, okay, you're getting kind of weird, soul dude. What the fuck? You know?
But I like the Nina Simone reference. That makes a lot of sense.
Well, I was listening a lot of Nina Simone when I recorded that song. Love me like you need me.
Yeah, man.
You know, it totally has her, that vibe of like the mid-period Nina.
Yeah. That's funny. I worked in a studio years ago that, and this is CDs, and we had one of those CD carousel things, and a Nina Simone disc had gotten stuck in there, and it wouldn't come out. And you could put other discs in, but that one wouldn't come out. And she was haunting us. So every once in a while, that disc would you know, queue up, and we'd be like, "Ooh, there she is."
There she is. Nina's here. Yeah, that sounds exactly like her from what I gather.
So you're going out on the road, which is really exciting. I'm going to get to see you. I'm going to get to see you play in May, which I'm really excited about.
I'm excited about that too.
What is the live rig like from guitar on? Take us through the signal chain.
Okay. Well, as I said, my guitar is typically. My main one is my number one, which is a 1962 Strat body, 55 Esquire neck.
Which is a cool look.
Yeah, it's a guitar I've had forever.
Yeah.
And a lot. So my spare, my number two, is built. My friend Chris Versaghi, who does Versaghi Custom Guitars, he took my guitar and really specced it out because it had been given to me by the Fender shop. Custom shop, and it was a bit lacking. So that even my second is, it's a rosewood as opposed to maple. But so that's my number one, and that's the guitar I played. I always joke I've tried to stop playing it my whole career, and so far I haven't. I take a couple of other guitars out that I use. I have a guitar called a Fatback Esquire style. It's a company out of Houston, and I use that for one of my alternate tunings. And then I also have is it called the Flat Rock model? I have to look that up. I'm having a brain fart, and I need to because they're, what's the company out of Detroit that does, it's like they make a lot of kind of tele, I'm just spacing on the name right now.
Not Reverend.
Yeah, Reverend.
Okay.
I think it's a Flat Rock. I forget what
it's called. Models that well.
Yeah, and I use that. I really, really like that guitar for my open G tuning stuff because it just has a. I used to use my Junior, and I just don't take that out anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that I use that. So those are my main guitars. On this tour, I'm using for the acoustic when I do use it. I have a Martin knockoff that's pretty good, but I have a Martin D28 that's my main acoustic guitar. And then as far as my pedal board, it's just been rebuilt, so it's totally different, and hopefully I'll know how to work it by then. but it's using an analog switcher / MIDI thing, and I did that because I've been using the Strymon Mobius and Timeline for about 2 or 3 years, and I've basically been using them for the most part with two patches, and I just started to, you know, it was just ridiculous. So George and Clint at Guitar Sanctuary totally hooked me up and helped me put it together, and so I have the Exotic Wah, which is an amazing Wah pedal. It's my favorite. I have that in Prescription. I actually prefer that Prescription for me. I have the Black Cat OD1. I have the Electro Harmonic Soul Food pedal, and then I have a custom fuzz that that Tripp's made for me, that's kind of a semi-prototype of the Bonamassa bus. It's like an early version. I use, I've got a Keeley four knob compressor. I use, of course, the Octafuzz that I've been using from Mike from Fulltone for a billion years. Mm-hmm. And as well as I use his, Deja Vibe. And there's actually, it's funny because not to beat up on Mike, because now he does say this, but for years I would be like, dude, because I had this one early Deja Vibe that was just insane. It sounds so good. It was in a square Hammond box. And then he went through all these iterations, and I would be like, you know, and I loved them all. I used them, but it was always like, yeah, that other one's better. And he's like, no, it's not. They're all the same. And I'm like, and then finally he came back to me. He's like, okay, I know why that one's better. And now he makes it. And so I have that one. And I don't know how, I don't remember how he differentiates them, but it's, I do know Univibes really well. I know that sound. I've used them through my whole career. And there's like, it's just a chewier sound. I don't know how else to say it. Mm-hmm. So using that, using the Strymon Timeline and the Strymon Mobius. And I also have, I don't know how you say it, that Bell Epic Echo Pedal as well. I think that's it. And then my amp is the Holy Watt, Ian Moore's signature prestige model.
That's cool. And how many watts is that? How many watts is that amp?
Well, I have two models, because, and any guitar player listening to this blog is going to go, hallelujah. Every time I get on stage, and I told Jim this, you know, with this 30-watt model, the Sandman's, it's always like some 22-year-old Sandman that's like, you know, I know you got to get your tone, man, but you're a little bit loud. Could you turn down a little bit? And it's just like, ugh. You know, so I'll try to baffle, because, you know, my main setting is it's like a thick, clean tone. And whenever I turn down, the tone gets significantly thinner, and it's completely different. I always say it goes from sounding like Denny Freeman to sounding like Nile Rodgers, which is not a bad thing, but just a totally different tone.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I got sick of doing that. So I do have a master volume, but I really don't like to use it. And Jim and I worked on the master volume, all the different iterations, and came up with what we think is the best one. But I have a 30 watt and I have a 15 watt. And my goal, you can laugh or say you did it, is to try to play the 15 watt live.
Really?
Well, yeah, that's my goal, theoretically. We'll see.
Okay.
You know, just because the 30 watt sounds amazing. And, you know, but I'm trying to see if I can do it with a lower stage volume. I told Jim I want to take them both out.
Right.
There are some nights where I will have to use the 15 watt when we're playing smaller rooms, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we'll see. I have them both. They both sound great. The 15 watt, I don't know, man. It doesn't sound like 15 watts to me. Jim swears it's 15 watts.
Well, you
it
know,
sounds
it's
like 28.
Yeah, 28 it's funny. More and more smaller amps, and I'm falling in love with smaller amps. They sound a lot louder than what they're rated.
I know. Oh, well, here's the deal. If anybody tells me that I'm too loud in a 15 watt amp, they can go fuck themselves. You know what I'm saying? Like,
I
at
hear
that
you.
Point, dude, 15 watt amp, that's a Princeton, right? I mean, what's right. a Princeton? Like 12 watts?
Yeah, so, yeah.
I mean, come on, 15. If I'm a guitar hero, I'm a guitar player in a guitar rock band, and 15 watts is too loud. So that's kind of my that's the end of the line for me. It's my line in the sand. Where anybody tells me to, I might actually hit them. I'm gonna try not to.
Somebody's gonna come up and hand you a champ.
I know, right? Oh, no. Here, let me tell you this story. This is actually great. This is my favorite guitar story of all time. I'm playing with Joe Ely. I'm 21 years old. And we're playing on this show called E-Town in Boulder at the Boulder Theater.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big show for Joe. And Joe's, you know, has a record out on MCA, and they're really trying to break him. And so, you know, we're all trying to do our part to help him. And so, of course, the guy comes up to me. He goes, "Hey, you know, man, I'm a huge guitar fan. They always start out the same way. I love the guitar, man. But, you know, you think you could turn down a little bit?" And I'm like, okay. And I'm on, like, you know, not just my superhero. I'm on, like, 5.5. So I'm like, turn it down to 4.5. And so, man, oh, that sounds so good, dude. You know, you're just still a little bit loud. You're really eating up the mix, man. Can you turn it down? So I turn it down to, like, 3.5, right? And it's getting kind of tinny. And then the guy comes up again. "I know you're going to hate me, man, but come on, bring it down a little. It's going to sound so good on the air. Wait till you hear it." So I turn it down to 2.5.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
And at this point, the amp just sounds like, you know, Mickey Mouse shit. It sounds terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, Super Reverb, for me, for the way I play on 2.5, it's just like, it just doesn't do the thing. But it's, you know, Joe's show, so I'm like, you know, and I'm just thinking, this guy's a total asshole, but I'll do it, whatever. He comes back up again, and I'm like, "You gotta be kidding. I'm on like 2.5. And he's like, "Yeah, I know, I hate myself, but can you turn it down?" So I'm just like, I get, you know, kind of pissy, and I just turn the volume to 0, and I play along, and the dude comes up to me, and he's like, "That's perfect."
Oh, no.
Yep. We laughed about that for about a week.
And what did Joe have anything to say?
Well, Joe was laughing, too. I mean, I ended up turning it back up for the show a little bit. I mean, I don't remember what it actually... I mean, and to me, whenever some guy starts doing that, I'm like, "Nah, I've already been here, dude. I was playing guitar when you weren't born."
Right,
you
know? Exactly. That's fantastic. I love it. Well, I got to tell you, man, this has been great. I've been, like I said, I've been following you since the first record, and it's been interesting to see you, you know, through this journey. And it really has been a journey, don't you think?
It definitely has been for me. I've been the one on it.
I mean,
no, it's been, you know, I just want to say, I mean, sitting here, maybe it's that I'm getting older. I'm so grateful, you know, and I say this at my shows a lot, and I really mean it. I think people that do follow me know that I'm not a hollow speaker, but I honestly, now that I've kind of, I am so grateful that my fans have tolerated all the twists and turns of my career,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of them have stuck with me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people will go, "Well, you know, I prefer your electric show or your acoustic, or your acoustic over your electric, or I like it when you sing like a girl or sing like a guy," or mm-hmm. whatever, you know, whatever. But, you know, I feel really lucky in being able to have the breadth that I have. I think people are pretty psyched that I'm playing the guitar and I'm digging it. And it seems like there's definitely a lot of synergy right now, but yeah, it's been a great journey and I wouldn't trade any of it.
Yeah. You know, and there aren't a lot of people that can say that, you know, your fan base stuck with you as you decided to grow, you know, cause some people get really stuck in this idea of, well, you know, "But it doesn't sound like that first record, man." That type of thing, you know. So.
Yeah, but, you know, people, and this is, you know, I've seen this so much lately. People come along. I think it's kind of the point is that if you're going to do something, you know, really make sure you do it. Like, do you really want to do something, or are you just trying to kind of be difficult or, you know, mm-hmm. obnoxious?
Mm-hmm.
Because I really think that, like, over time, even, like, I have people come up to me all the time, guitar, and mainly, you know, guitar fans that have fallen in love with my acoustic show.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it took them a while. And mm-hmm. it just, you know, I think what they realize is, like, I think at first they think they maybe don't trust you. They think you're full of shit. They think you're trying to sell records or fit in or be cool or do something, or, you know, you moved up to the Northwest and got all hippie and weird, or, you know, whatever people think. But after a time, they start to see you. It's kind of like seeing that weird dude at the coffee shop, and you just start to realize that he's just him, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, people, you know, start, you know, that's always been my tack. I'm like, look, this is me. I've always been like this. This is not, you know, I was like this in my first record, you know. I've always been the same. And just because you caught me at a period of time, you know, before I played guitar, I played classical violin. Before that, I played the sitar.
Right.
You know, when I was 17 years old, I wanted to be John Coltrane. I mean, you know, and then Ravi Shankar, and, you know, and then I wanted to be the Beatles, and, you know, I'm consistently different. I mean, I've always been this way, and it just, you know, took some fans 20 years to kind of figure out that that was actually me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, man, just keep doing it. Cause it's
right on. Well, thank you so much for this. So we're doing this at what time next week?
This is going to air, right? Yeah. This has been cathartic for me.
Awesome. Totally. Well,
I can't wait. I can't wait to come over and meet you and shake your hand when I get to see those amps and stuff like that, and get to see you play again. I haven't seen you play in quite a while, actually. So,
right on. Well, we should be pretty good. We're doing a lot of touring between now and then. So
that's cool.
I'm hoping to be in top form.
Yeah, I was looking at the website, and I didn't see any Austin dates yet. So
Austin show. Well, we will be playing in Austin for South by, but I honestly don't even really list that, because to me it's just a whole different thing.
It's a different thing.
Do you want to get in the carnival or not?
Yeah.
My big Austin show, and what I honestly, as silly as this sounds, consider kind of my record release for this record, is not until June 1st.
Oh, wow. Where is that going to be?
Yep. Antone's anniversary.
Oh, freaking cool. I'm there.
Yep. Yep, me too.
Ian, man, thanks so much for being on the show. This has been great.
Great talking to you. Well, I can't wait to hear it. Let me know when it goes live.
I will. I'll send you links.
All right. Right on.
All right. Take care now.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Check out Guitar Radio Show on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, Instagram, and Tumblr. And, of course, on guitarradioshow.com.